Once more unto the breach, dear friend, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake McClure. And so we'll say other things like interesting and, on the other hand, throughout the hour, just to spice up our conversation, because we know how fascinating we sound when we say interesting.
So, well, the big news for the week was the consumer price index.
Yep. It was a big news.
And I mentioned this in the newsletter, and if you don't take our newsletter, certainly you can contact us and we'll send it to you. But people look at the one-year consumer price index report and say, that's inflation. No, not at all. Tells you what inflation did over the last 12 months. But in this particular case, and if it's moving, if inflation is changing very, very slowly, it has some accuracy. But in this particular case, the inflation it's reporting occurred 6 to 9 months ago. And what we're seeing right now is not inflation. Let me explain why. The 12-month headline consumer price index number was 6.5%.
So inflation is down to 6.5%, lower than it was before, but still absurdly high.
Well, okay. The one-month inflationary and CPI change inflation rate in the United States was negative 0.3%. The two-month rate in the United States is negative 0.4%. Prices, on average, have been coming down now for 3 months. So the inflation rate is not currently 6.5%, despite the political and punditry that say it is. The current inflation rate is negative.
If we look back a year, we're 6.5% above a year ago. However, all that gain took place 9 months ago to a year ago. The biggest gains that took place were back in June of last year. June and March of last year were some really big gains. Well, let's think about that. What was causing this? When we look at the inflation numbers, we had some very, very low inflation numbers in March of 2020. That's in the depths of the pandemic. We just announced we go into lockdown mode. Inflation actually fell through the floor at that point. We had deflation because we weren't buying a bunch of stuff that we normally bought. We didn't know what we were going to buy, but we weren't in a buying frenzy yet. The following 2 months is when we saw such phenomena as the toilet paper running out, or runs on toilet paper, or other jokes having to do with runs and toilet paper. We started to see supply chain issues really cropping up in May and in June, and so prices started up. And those prices didn't come down for a while. Then coming forward to 2021, supply chain issues were abundant. There were lockdowns happening sporadically all over the world still. We're starting to loosen up our lockdown in the United States. Stimulus checks are coming out to preserve our income when a lot of us got laid off. Unemployment checks were larger than usual. People weren't spending still. Prices were going up because it was really hard to get the things that we normally got, but most people didn't get those things. Most people weren't hoarding toilet paper, although a lot of people did. Most didn't. If you come a year out from that into June of 2022, when people are out and about and going back to work and back to shopping and back to buying things, but other parts of the world are still in lockdown, we couldn't get the things that we wanted, so we were willing to pay more for it. That's the definition of inflation. Come forward to now, and you hear people talking about cutting back. You see prices coming down at the pump. You see prices coming down at Target and at Walmart. They're still higher than they were a year ago. This is what we're seeing here. And so we've come through this. That's the spectrum of inflation. And when you see a headline that says year over year, 6.5%, we still feel it, but prices are actively coming down. And I just repeated what you said, but with some historical context. I think the looking at the timeline of what happened and why the prices spiked, and you can see another big price spike in March of 2022, right after the invasion of Ukraine, when oil prices jumped up and grain prices jumped up. Year over year, the grain and oat prices are down from a year ago. Steel prices are down from a year ago. So a lot of the commodity prices are leading the way in the downward move. And you said this at the beginning of last hour. If you watch oil and you see oil spike, then you're likely to see inflation spike 3 to 4 months later. And we're seeing that on the other end as well. As oil prices have come down, as commodity prices have come down, we're seeing the inflation prices or the inflation numbers coming down as well. We're still above what we were a year ago, 2 years ago, and 3 years ago. And some of the things are never going to return to those prices. You know, what you pay to an electrician is unlikely to come back down to what we saw 3 years ago. What you pay in rent is unlikely to come back down, at least for a while, until we have more houses. So some parts of inflation are sticky, and some parts aren't. So electronic prices are, just expect car prices, house prices, both used and new car prices, both used and new house prices to come down. Expect a lot electronics prices to come down. These are things that you're going to see the prices start coming down, and most notably over the next few months.
Yep, I agree with you completely. Couldn't say it more. The other thing that is important to understand about inflation in this particular case, and I realize this is politically unpopular, but I'm going to say it. It doesn't make any difference which side of the aisle you're blaming for inflation because of the stimulus bills. Both sides were behind them. But doesn't make any difference which political party you're in or which side of the political spectrum you're on. The stimulus bills did not cause inflation.
This is provable.
I can say that with a great deal of accuracy, sincerity, and a lot of folks who are very smart, who have been very accurate over the years, back me up.
Hold on a second. Let me throw in a question. How can that be? We had stimulus and then we had inflation. How can you say that this isn't caused by that? Go ahead.
Well, you know, I go home from work every evening and then it gets dark.
Whoa.
So my going home from work doesn't cause it to get dark.
Wait a minute.
That's the easiest way.
If you go home every evening, what happens if you don't go home? It might not get dark.
You're right. I need to try that out, but I would have to try it a lot.
Go ahead.
But the point I wanted to make is everyone who has studied this, and there's been a lot of people take hard looks at this, about 0.1% of the CPI may have been caused by the stimulus. It may not have been. We'd have to run an experiment where we had a pandemic with no stimulus. Actually, we did run an experiment where we had a pandemic with no stimulus and a pandemic with stimulus.
So this is the
provability.
Europeans
had the Europeans had no stimulus bills, and their inflation was worse than ours with the stimulus bill, and that's a pretty good indication that the stimulus packages did not cause inflation. Now, there was a difference between the two. Europe went into a pretty severe recession and is in one right now. We didn't. And there is where the stimulus bills did make a big difference. We didn't go into a pretty severe recession, and they did go into a pretty severe recession. We went into a mild recession, came right back out of it, and they didn't. So the stimulus bills had an effect, and inflation was not one of those effects. We like to blame things. Whichever party you're in, and I don't know who, obviously you're listening and I can't see you or talk to you or find out which party, whatever party you're in, I'm sure you're convinced that the people in the other party caused inflation, or you may not be, but if you are,
most people are.
It's
most
not
people
true.
Are. The Democrats firmly believe that Trump caused inflation. The Republicans, now this is maybe the vocal arm of the Democrats. The vocal arm of the Republicans firmly believe that Biden caused inflation. And if it makes you feel good to believe either one of those, don't let us take that good feeling away. You can continue to do that. We're not trying to challenge that belief. If it makes you feel good to blame the other person, it's probably not actually hurting the other person, so feel good. But the reality is that it's not either party that caused it. Otherwise, right, they wouldn't have had inflation in Germany and in China and in Turkey and in Spain at the same time that we had our inflation here, because they don't have Biden and Trump over there. They're probably happy that they don't have Biden and Trump over there. And we're probably happy that we don't have Erdogan over here.
Well, I think actually most of the Republicans wish that Biden were in Turkey. And most of the Democrats really wish that Trump were in Turkey.
Not in. You can. They just think they are turkeys.
Oh, maybe that's true.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very kind way of saying it from their perspective, I think.
I'm
in a great place where I think both of them are turkeys.
I don't think either one of them are turkeys, but that's all right. I think they're just people. Anyway, but the consumer price index, now there's something interesting going on inside the consumer price index that I find very fascinating. The prices of goods, that stuff that you buy, has been dropping quite a lot. That's where we get the negative short-term numbers from, is the dropping of the prices of goods, stuff you buy, or in the vernacular, stuff. For example, cars are down rather dramatically. Over the last 2 months, for example, transportation as a whole has dropped 4.5%, which is a big chunk of what we do. Motor fuel is down 15.5% over the last 2 months. Gasoline's down, motor fuel in general, that includes diesel. So we have a lot of things. We have some things going down. Energy and everything else, if you leave out shelter, has been dropping. The price of services, on the other hand, continues to rise. Meat is down. Eggs are up.
Eggs are up for a different reason. Avian flu. Right. We had a big avian flu outbreak, which caused a lot of chickens to die or be killed because they might have been infected. So our egg prices are way up.
Going out to eat has cost 1% more now than it did 2 months ago on average in the United States. Why is that? Well, because if you look over at what the major expense is in a restaurant, it is the people who get paid to do the stuff in the restaurant, not the food. The cost of the food they're buying is going down, but the cost of labor is going up. Why is it going up? Because we have record low unemployment, 3.5%. That's as low as it's been ever. We have a lot of people who want to go out to eat because they're still surging from the pandemic time when they didn't.
Because we have few unemployed people who like to actually go out and have someone else prepare the food for them when they've been working.
Yes, that's true. So what we've got is a labor shortage in the United States. And the Federal Reserve has stated very clearly, Chairman Powell has stated again and again, the issue is he's concerned about the fact that there's a high number of job openings in the United States and low number of people who are looking for work. Therefore, the supply and demand issue will cause the price of wages to continue to rise. Well, unfortunately or fortunately, he's wrong, because the wage prices, the wages are not going up as fast as inflation right now, and they're slowing back down again. And what that means is it is different. Employers are hoarding employees. It takes, as the technological advances and everything else that's going on in our society have caused it to be more and more and more expensive to hire somebody and train them. Therefore, as business slows down or looks like it might slow down, employers are tending to hang on to their existing employees very carefully and not get rid of them any more than they would sell an expensive piece of machinery after they bought it. The reason is because it takes a long time to train an employee, and it's really hard to get one once you lay one off to get another one. So they're tending to what's called employee hoard. This is causing some distortions in the numbers that the Federal Reserve is reading, which means it's different this time. And hopefully they will recognize it appears to be different this time and that the demand for labor is not as high as the numbers would indicate. We'll see. We'll hope that works out. And it's pretty well assured at this point, although not certain, that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates another quarter point at the next meeting.
Yeah, that's the message that they're kind of percolating out there.
But what happens after that is something we need to watch and see. If inflation continues to be month over month negative and it continues to be negative, I can't imagine that they would continue to raise the interest rates in the face of a declining cost of living.
Yeah. So on the
we'll see how that works out.
When we're looking at the core numbers, we're not seeing consistent negatives. The core numbers are you take out food and energy because they're volatile and they may not have to do with interest rates or anything else. So you take them out. And this month, we had a 0.3% increase on the core side month to month. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that we're not likely to raise interest rates drastically if we keep seeing those numbers, but it's not negative. So we're talking about the 2.5 to 2% range that is well within the Fed's target. If we see negatives and low numbers consistently, we don't expect the Fed to keep raising rates. We think they're going to do it another quarter point because they're saying that. But that's where we are right now, is that we said this actually back in October, that we thought we were past peak inflation. And it seems like that we've gotten that pretty dead on. And it isn't because we're prescient. We didn't have a crystal ball. We were looking at shipping. We were looking at supply chains kind of unraveling and then getting re-raveled and untangled. And we have a lot of new supply chains out there. The networks are reforming and they're more redundant. We're not having ships waiting off the coast of California to come in and unload. The way that the ports are being managed is changing. There's a great article in The Economist about a port in Singapore that I've been following this for years, but it's actually meeting the expectations that they had. So in Singapore, which is a city-state, it's an island city-state, how do they find space to put in a new port when they've basically filled up their island already? Well, they're reclaiming land. What does that mean? It's not really reclaiming. It's claiming new land. They are making new land on the edge of their island to create a port. And the port is almost completely automated. And parts of the port are coming online for testing purposes already. What do you mean completely automated, Jake? Normally at a port, you have thousands of truck drivers that just are either coming into, out of the port, or work there every day. Because they've got to drive trucks for these big cranes to pick up the containers off the ship and put on the back of a truck, and then that truck either moves to a different place in the port to put it on a different ship, or moves to the outflow area where the trucks are leaving to go somewhere else, or they take it to the railroad where the container is lifted off and put there. So there's thousands of drivers that are involved in this. And in Singapore, they're just flat vehicles that don't have a cab. These containers are being lifted by an unmanned crane to put the containers on an unmanned vehicle that takes it to other parts of the port to unmanned, put them on another ship. And this is the future. I mean, we've been talking about this being the future for a long time, but this is going to be implemented everywhere because the technology is being developed. And that's going to make our prices come back down again for many of these things. When I'm saying that we had hundreds of ships sitting off the ports of California during the worst part of the supply chain issues. We don't have a waiting line anymore. So all of that stuff that we were saying at the time, these are the reasons why the prices are up. And then the final massive, it's not even just a piece of the puzzle, it's like three quarters of the puzzle, China's opening up again. They have a lot of uphill battle. There's going to be a lot of fatalities from COVID because they're not well vaccinated. They've got a lot of issues with their medical systems. They've got traveling for the Lunar New Year happening over this period going forward for the next 3 or 4 weeks. All that being said, the factories are running again, which means that the exports are moving back up into full drive again, which means prices are coming back down again. All of that's fitting together with what we would expect to see. It's not mysticism or weird predictions about the future when you say, all right, what causes prices to go up? Well, a lack of supply. Well, the supply is picking back up. The reason why car prices have been just through the roof, they were a leading cause of the inflation that we've felt, with 20 and 30% increases in prices for used automobiles year over year for multiple years in a row, which means you might have started with a $10,000 used car, and then a year later, it was $14,000, and then the year after that, people were willing to give you $20,000 for that car. It doubled in price. That's not abnormal for what we've seen, a doubling in price in used cars. Well, why was that? Well, because we didn't have enough computer chips to make the new cars. And now we've got an abundance of computer chips. Computer chip prices are down by 50% over the last 12 months because we're building more and more new facilities to make them. We recognize this was a supply chain issue that caused us not to be able to sell stuff profitably. Ford didn't like that. Tesla didn't like that. General Motors didn't like not being able to sell you cars when you wanted them. So they've done everything that they can think of to make it so that the things that stopped them from selling you stuff and making a profit are being removed from the picture. That's going to cause prices to come down. Automation is taking over in a lot of areas. We said this was going to happen almost 3 years ago at the depths of the pandemic, that this was going to inspire corporations to do things they'd never done before. And looking at my computer screen as I'm doing this radio program, this podcast across with you, older Baldy, we said this before the program began. We're sitting, he's at his office, I'm in my home office. We are connected digitally and then connected again digitally to the studio, which is then broadcasting through an analog tower to a lot of people. And we're digitally recording this, which is then being uploaded to networks of podcasts so that we're available everywhere on the planet. All of that is visible on my computer screen right now with a series of different windows. Most of that stuff wasn't even available, at least not in the ease of use that we have today. 3 years ago, we couldn't do this. And that communication technology is a precursor for growth in the economy, period. If you look back to every major, massive, innovational change in our economies, the great revolutions of industry and so on, were based on communication technology, whether that's transportation or direct communication, the telegraph, the Gutenberg press. We've just come through a big sea change in another area, and I think it's just as important as what we are seeing with interest rates, maybe more so. I think in 100 years, they may discuss the interest rates in a very esoteric fashion, but they're going to be pointing to the fact that we had direct, instantaneous communication going on in ways that we couldn't have imagined in previous decades, and that was the seed to the growth that we're seeing. And I expect to see growth there. That was a very long-winded statement about what's happening right now.
But it's very accurate. I completely agree with you, everything you said. There are a couple of other things going on in the economy. The manufacturing PMI. Boy, that's a geeky term, isn't it?
Yes.
The Purchasing Managers Index. And there's a couple of them that are out there. Purchasing managers are good at forecasting what's coming down the road for the next 6 to 8 months, because companies have the purchase managers who buy the raw materials or the parts or whatever they need to make whatever it is they're going to make, and they don't do that until they get the orders. So when purchase managers start buying a lot of stuff, it means that we're going to have a lot of things happen in manufacturing down the road on the manufacturing side.
Yeah, do you mind if I...
Interestingly enough.
quick interject to that. So you don't buy the steel to build the building until somebody says they're going to build a building?
Yep.
Right.
That's common sense. Purchasing managers generally buy the steel after they are confirmed that somebody's going to buy it from them.
And even on the services side, the purchasing managers index is important because, for instance, using the classical service business of a restaurant, restaurants get a feel probably more quickly and more accurately than other people do for what's happening in their customer base. And when they sense that they're going to get more people coming in to buy steak, for example, they tell their purchase managers to arrange contracts to buy steaks down the road for the next several months. And that way they get them less expensively. So purchasing managers have a better view of what's coming down the road in many cases than the rest of us do. So a couple of companies go out there and do the purchasing managers index. The PMI, as it's called, for purchase for manufactured goods, is sitting around 48 right now. Now, what does that mean? Anything below 50 indicates that it's shrinking. In other words, they're buying less stuff than they've bought in the recent past. And so you have, in the manufacturing side of our economy right now, we have a deceleration. We have the amount of things that are likely to be made in the next several months declining. Is that bad? No. Why? Because we had this huge surge coming out of the pandemic that was not sustainable.
It was up in the 60s, way right. too much and expansion.
So one of the reasons prices went up and we had inflation is people were buying, people were buying a lot of stuff and it wasn't available. Then the industry started catching up and making a lot of stuff. And now people are coming back to something closer to normal buying procedures. And the PMI is starting to decline. So this is not a bad thing that the PMI is coming down there. The problem, and this is one of the things the Federal Reserve is looking at, is the PMI over on the services side is still in the 60s. It's still too high. Too high meaning it's not really sustainable to run at that level for a long period of time. Why is it so high? Well, first, there's a lag in it. And secondly, if you've been to a restaurant in the last several months, you'll notice they tend to be jammed. Although I have noticed something recently in the past few weeks, there is less crowding in restaurants now than there was, which means that is likely to come down in the near future too. What's the total story there? The total story is that the economy is slowing down to a sustainable rate. Now, how fast is it going already?
By slowing down, really what's happened is we sped way up. And if you slow down, think about this. If you slow down the rate of acceleration, you're still speeding up. In other cases, we're actually slowing down from the high degree of speed. So there's a lot of conflicting numbers there. Some places we're speeding up less quickly, and some places we're slowing down. All right, now back to you.
So what we're doing is returning to a more sustainable normal rate. Why do I think we're in an unsustainable rate? Well, Moody's Analytics probably, at least in my experience, has had the best guesstimate of where the GDP for the gross domestic product of the United States will come out for a quarter. The fourth quarter has not been reported yet by the Commerce Department. So we don't know what it is, but it's only their first estimate. When the Commerce Department comes out with it, they have at least three estimates and sometimes four before they get it right. So it'll be distantly in the future before we know what happened in the fourth quarter, which gives us a real pain sometimes, but that's all right. They're suggesting, at least their estimate, according to Moody's Analytics, is that the annualized growth rate of the economy of the United States in the fourth quarter of last year will come in around 4.3%. That is amazingly high. 4.3% is faster than our economy can sustain. We simply can't make, we have the largest economy in the world. Growing at 4.3% is just not something that can be sustained in an economy this size. We don't have the logistics. We don't have the systems to do that.
Let me
going to come down from there. But yeah, what I wanted to point out
just
is this is not the behavior of a GDP that's approaching a recession.
Right.
You don't go from 4.3 to negative in a quarter or even in two quarters. The momentum created by a 4.3% annualized growth rate, it's a speed, in the fourth quarter would take at least three quarters and maybe four if we were unwinding at a very high rate of speed, which we're not. There's no indication the economy is slowing down anywhere out there. We're maybe growing less fast. So despite the fact that there are some statistical numbers out there that would indicate, like the inverted yield curve, that we may be approaching a recession, the underlying economy is saying exactly the opposite. And the question is, do we believe the tea leaves, the traditional indicators that we have a recession coming, or do we believe what the economy is actually doing to be the predictor of what it's going to do? And the answer is, it is different this time. We didn't have a pandemic when we looked at these things before. We didn't have an invasion of Ukraine when we looked at these things before.
We didn't have
China in a lockdown.
Yeah, that stimulus money that we've mentioned before, there's a lot of money still sitting in banks, and that's being spent down, but it's not being spent down as quickly as a lot of people estimated. That's what's sustaining us through this. So all of that put together, when you have massive savings, you have all of this, you know, the inverted yield curve, the normal things that say, hey, look ahead, we might be having a recession. It's fascinating because the conflicting signals are coming together. We might have that mythical, not actually seen in the last five decades, of a soft landing, where the Federal Reserve might actually get what they wanted. That would be weird. That would be the difference this time concept of, we've never actually had a Federal Reserve-led soft landing. We keep having it as a promise. It'd be kind of cool if it worked out this time. It looks like they may actually be doing it. How's that for weird?
Well, it's something we can hope for. Now, there's other factors to be considered here. And one of them, and it's not making the headlines outside of the, it's not even making a headline in the Wall Street Journal, but it's there. On the 19th of this month, the United States government will be forced to technically cease borrowing.
Yeah.
We will have hit the debt ceiling limit. That means to the degree that we are.
Extraordinary measures.
To the degree that we're paying, as Treasury securities that were issued in the past come due and we pay them, we can borrow that amount of money again, but we can't increase our borrowing. But our budget is higher than it was. It's been going up for a long, 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 long time. When the Republicans control the Congress and the presidency, during the Trump administration, the budget went up. When the Democrats controlled, the budget went up. And there really isn't any significant difference between these. As a matter of fact, if you want to look at the actual numbers, the Republicans increased spending more than the Democrats did, and I don't know that there's any significance to that other than the fact that it just happened. But it did happen. So here's the point that I want to make. There is a risk factor out there to the economy and to the market that's now in place. The same group of about 20 Republicans, that caused there to be multiple ballots for speaker, which hasn't happened in 100 years. Some of them, and I don't know anyone speaking for the entire group, but at least some of them have said they're willing to shut the government down and default on the payment of treasuries, the payment of the just debts of the United States government, if they don't get their way. Now, whether they mean that or not, I don't know, but it's a risk factor. Why is it a risk factor? Because literally everything we do in the United States and in much of the world is based on a foundational belief that the United States will always pay its debts. If the bill has been passed by Congress that orders the Treasury to spend money, and the Treasury didn't get a tax bill associated with it that caused them to have to raise taxes to make that money, then the Treasury is forced to borrow money. And when they borrow money, it's because Congress, the law requires them to do so. The money needs required to be spent. If Congress were to stop that and say, no, the way we're going to cut our budget is if you're in your house and you have a high credit card bill, and you say, the way we're going to cut our budget is we're not going to pay on our credit card or our mortgage. What would happen if you stopped paying your mortgage payments? Would it reduce your expenses and cut your budget? It would. But I don't think it would be a good thing. And that's the kind of situation that we potentially could face in the next 6 months. And it is something. You want to worry about something? There's something to worry about.
Yeah. If we hit the debt ceiling, this is a question we get a lot. We hit the debt ceiling and the U.S. Treasurer, the Secretary of Treasury says, we're going into extraordinary measures. It sounds very British. What does it mean? What is it that, well, how are they doing that? They can't borrow money, but we are now spending more money than we're making on revenue. Where's the money coming from? And the answer is interesting. Some of the obligations that the government has that they don't have to do that other people would be as an interesting little tidbit. When you've got treasury bonds held in federal employee retirement accounts, the TSP. So the bond positions in the TSP can be sold. The TSP is the thrift savings program. It is the retirement plan that's not part of the pension system. It's like the equivalent of a 401k for federal employees. The U.S. government doesn't inform the TSP folks. They just say, hey, we're going to continue to pay you interest on this, but we're going to liquidate the bond itself and use that money to pay other things because we're not constitutionally obligated to put money in the pension system. How's that for weird? They halt contributions to certain government pension funds other than the TSP. They suspend state and local government series securities. They borrow money set aside for exchange rate fluctuations. What is that? Well, if we have international purchases required by the U.S. Treasury, there's a reserve set aside for if the dollar drops in value right before we need to buy the thing that we're obligated to buy. Well, we can dip into that reserve fund. None of them are permanent solutions. If Congress said you need to spend more money than we received in tax revenue, and then Congress says, but you can't borrow more money, at some point something will break. That's the truth. There's at some point they can't spend more money than they've earned without borrowing the money, and Congress is the one that said spend it. And Congress is also the one that says don't borrow it. It doesn't matter if Trump is president or Biden is president. It still falls to Congress to do this correctly. Pay your obligations, dudes. There you go. Don't obligate yourself if you're not going to pay it. And I know that this Congress is different than the last Congress, but this isn't the way. You don't go to a party at work and order a whole bunch of food at the restaurant and then leave and expect somebody else to pay it. That's not nice. But then the somebody else that's supposed to pay it for the party shouldn't not pay it either. Both not nice. That second one is not nice to the restaurant who's already given you the food. The first not nice is just not nice to you in the same Congress. Yeah. There. That was my attempt at shaming Congress. I somehow I don't think it worked. I don't think Congress is now weeping in guilt and misery and saying, "You're right. We're raised the debt ceiling, Jake. You've convinced us that we're going to hurt the restaurant owner over there."
Well, actually, it's a very important point here, and that is the vast majority of Republican congressmen would not fail to pay the just debts of the United States. But right. We're in an odd position. And I don't have any question that the radicals and the Democrats would do the same thing if they were in the same position. But we're in a position right now where the Republicans have a 10-vote majority in the House of Representatives. That's all they have. And that means that 10 votes, 11 votes, can basically stop legislation. Because the Democrats are going to vote one way on something, and the Republicans are going to vote the other way on something. And if they don't get 11 more votes, neither one of them gets a majority. And if neither one of them gets a majority, then nothing passes.
And that presumes none of them are sick for a given vote. If you have a normal day in Congress, there's between 5 and 8 people that aren't there due to illness. That's just normal because you've got more than 400 people all together. Of course, you're going to have some people that are sick. It's true at any business. And that means that the majority, if the Republicans are the sick ones, that particular day, it's there's not much of a majority. So this is generally good from an economics perspective in that we're probably not going to get any stupid laws passed during the next 2 years. But we're probably not going to get any good laws passed either. So there you go.
We do need to have particularly budget laws passed every year. Otherwise, yeah, we don't have any money.
Yeah, we don't
literally
actually
don't have any money.
The government doesn't function. Yeah, it's not a good thing.
And one of the things that we get hit with is this threat that comes around almost seasonally, that we will not raise the budget ceiling if we don't get our way on something. And that is the threat to blow up the whole thing. And it is time for us to do some commercials.
Yes. So rather than talking brinksmanship and who's going to play chicken and not swerve, that's what happens with these things, we're going to play some commercials instead. If you'd like to join the conversation, our email addresses are available and waiting diligently, patiently for your emails. The email addresses are jake@tpwc.com and jeff@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or the personal wealth coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important messages. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. Today, we only have 10 minutes, 9 minutes left this
week. Do you realize we survived yesterday?
Friday the 13th?
Yes.
I'm not sure. We could be in a simulation, according to Elon Musk. We may not have. We may be on our second, iteration. You never know.
Elon Musk actually said that.
He says we might be in a simulation, and if a simulation is our version of reality, he might be right, because it's just a different name for what we're living in.
Okay, whatever he says. Be interesting to find out who's running the simulation, though. Anyway,
yeah, it's the white mice.
Simulation.
The white mice.
Got it.
The scientists are the white mice, and they're running a simulation to answer the great question. The great question of life, the universe, and everything.
I think it's worth summarizing something here. And the fact is that the United States economy is functioning very, very well right now. As a matter of fact, if anything, too well. It's running along at a pace that has been running at a pace this year that is not sustainable. But that's all right, because it ran at a slow pace in the years before. I think there is a return to normal, but the return to normal in our economy, in our markets, will be something different than the old normal. Now, will there be some striking revelation I can tell you, other than the fact that interest rates will not be declining precipitously as they have over the last 40 years? No. I can tell you that after a traumatic event, and the pandemic was definitely a traumatic event, things will be different when we come out of it, because we will be busy reacting to it. Just as over the last decade, we have been reacting to what was called the Great Recession and the financial crisis. To give you an example about some of that reacting, banks, the major banks have been reporting, the gigantic banks have been reporting their earnings this week, and they are setting aside very substantial cash reserves, like they're headed into a Great Recession. But none of their indicators internally suggest that their business is slowing down.
Yeah.
So what we've got is, we are not going to have another great financial crisis, because the banks are going to be sitting on big fat cushions of money. And what else does that mean? Also, the put to call ratio, which I know that's beyond most people's comprehension. In some degree, it's beyond mine. Basically, the put-to-call ratio indicates that there are a lot of people out there, a lot of speculators, who believe that the market is going to crater sometime in the immediate future. So they have bought options to force somebody to purchase stocks at the current price that it's at today after the market falls. And that is an indicator that we're about to have a bull market, by the way, because at some point, these calls have to be liquidated and bought back. And it's a little complicated, but the bottom line to it is also the shorting, the number of shorts are still are pretty high. There's a lot of indicators from the fact that the banks are hoarding money. Other people are hoarding money. People are hoarding employees. And bettors, speculators in the market are betting the market is going to fall. All of which tends to suggest that we're not going to have a recession. Now, I know that sounds backwards, but the preparation for a down market that is widespread right now, the preparation for a recession, which is widespread right now, tends to cause it not to happen. I know that sounds strange, but that's the reality. Right. And all of that money and all of that backlog of preparation is going to have to be liquidated at some point and something done with it, which will cause the next boom to hit us.
Yeah.
And I kind of think we're 2023 will be looked back on. We'll say that was an unexpectedly good year.
I wouldn't be surprised. I think that particularly market related, even if we get a recession this year, the market tends to be recovering when the recession's announced. And if you look at the European indexes, their recession is definitely going and they have their stock market is doing quite well. In fact, it's this year doing better than the U.S. stock market because that's typically what happens. The stock market is a leading indicator of the economy. It's not always right, but it tends to lead. I mean, we've never had a recession without a bear market beforehand. We've had bear markets without recessions, but we've never had a recession without a bear market. And we've never had a booming economy that didn't have a bull market start before it. And so that's just, it looks good. It looks like we went through a tough time last year getting the supply chain figured out, China still being all wrapped up in COVID and lockdowns and slowing all of that, interest rates coming up. But it looks like we're kind of getting our act together across the planet. That's good news. It's going to be chaotic. Don't get me wrong there. It's chaotic in government. It doesn't really matter which government you're looking at. United States government looks chaotic right now. Go almost anywhere in the world and the governments look chaotic. And that's normal coming out of a plague. We call them pandemics today, but this is a very normal thing. Everything gets shaken up. And these big social changes that take place from isolation to reopening economies to do I trust you to breathe on me in the same room? This goes back many thousands of years. There's lots of evidence for us to look at. Governments have weird shifts at this point. We're seeing very normal things. Interest rates change around pandemics, previously known as plagues. They're being done in a much more structured and organized manner across the planet today than they did the last major plague that hit the planet. So I don't know if I should knock on a lot of wood or throw some salt over my shoulder or something, but we seem to be figuring things out from history. I don't want to make that as a prediction. That generally comes right before we forget history completely and go do stupid things. So the things look good at the moment based on a historical analysis of where we are in this particular pandemic. We're doing things the way we normally do, but without quite as horrible repercussions across things. I hope we can do it the next pandemic too. Maybe do it even better. That'd be weird.
Well, I think that better. By the next pandemic, we will have forgotten.
Yeah.
They generally tend to come around once a century.
We tend to congratulate ourselves on how well we did it and then forget how we did it for the next time because we did it so well we don't have to remember.
There are crises that we set aside, we created organizations to deal with in advance, and we worked on it really, really hard, and then the crisis didn't come along for a couple of decades, and it got defunded, and then we get hit with another crisis that we're not prepared for.
Right. But we're about out of time for this week. Thank you very much for listening. We're still optimistic, even with all that gloom and doom that we threw in here. We're really optimistic about where we're headed. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we do give personalized fiduciary investment advice to foundations, trusts, corporations, people of high net worth, all that good stuff. We have voicemail waiting during the weekend and real live people during the week. Locally, the phone number is
254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can sign up for our newsletter, read the newsletter going back, listen to radio programs, find our podcast or anywhere podcasts are provided. Contact us through the contact form or email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.